Hi, Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Scott.
Hey, everybody. Can I see the hands of people in their first year? Great. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for having me. Come on up and hang out with you today. It looks like you guys had a great weekend. I love these AA functions. I love these AA events. They're the only thing that I did when I was new. They're the only, like, gatherings of people that I felt comfortable at all. I didn't know how to attend gatherings of people. I didn't, unless, you know, people were, you know, gathering to inject heroin or, you know, some of the other great social tools that I used when I was out there. Or just, you know, get together and go to someone's house and hit on their wife, try to borrow 20 bucks of them, you know, go in the bathroom, go through their medicine cabinet, piss on their toilet seat, and go home. You know, that kind of successful social intercourse, which I was used to having, you know. So coming from that uncivilized state to being in the company of other people in this new way was a really bizarre. I really felt radioactive. So if you're new here and you're really... You know, what's this? You know, what are we doing? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to tell a lot of jokes? Am I supposed to be sort of the, you know, what's the deal here, you know? You'll find out if you keep coming back. If you're wondering when you're going to get in touch with a higher power, if you're new, don't drink, go to meetings, and you'll be contacted, you know? I guarantee it. There's only one really funny thing in this room, and that's this sign, I think, is just an absolute pisser. So I hope I've been spiritual enough so far, and it's probably going to get a little more spiritual. And if you had shown me this sign 13 years ago, I don't even know what I would have done. I think my brain would have blown up or something. I would have been looking for Rod Serling, I'll tell you that. I mean, this is, from where I come from, this sign is... There's a lot of sense of humor behind this sign. So I'd like to welcome you. If you're new, if you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And just suggest that you catch alcoholism. Just catch alcoholism. You can have anything else you want. Just catch the alcoholism. Because if you don't catch it, you can die from it. And if you catch it, you can get better. A lot of people don't catch alcoholism and they die from it. You see it happen all the time. If you're a tweaker, I'd like to welcome you. But do those people come with batteries or what? They stay quick for a while, the tweakers, you know. Man. Woo! A friend of mine heard a guy recently identify as a crack monster. Wow, I'll tell you. That's scary. Crack monster. Ooh. Does Thrifty have a crack monster Halloween costume? Now look, I'm not putting you down. My only point here is we have a book about alcoholism written by alcoholics. We don't have a book for like a dope Goliath, you know, if you're like the Bigfoot of dope addicts, you know? That's all fine and well. Just catch alcoholism. We don't have a book for that other stuff. And the reason why I'm talking about it is that I almost died from alcoholism because I was a drug addict. It kept me out there longer and longer and longer because I could not possibly have been an alcoholic. I was not an alcoholic when I came to AA. So if you're new here and you're not an alcoholic, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. Just stick around long enough to find out if you've got the dreaded alcoholism. Now, you're going to hear some pretty dopey things about alcoholism now that you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll hear it from me. I hear the dopey stuff in AA and out of AA. One of the supremely dopey things you can hear outside of AA is, if you're new, some people might say to you, gee, isn't Alcoholics Anonymous just another crutch? Which is sort of like saying to a diabetic, are you still using that insulin stuff? Boy, I don't know. Sure wish you had a little backbone or a little gumption there. You wouldn't need that gall darn insulin. That's how deranged that idea is. Alcoholism is recognized as a disease by the AMA, the World Health Organization, and every organization of psychiatrists, physicians, and therapists on the planet. Maybe Ceylon is still holding out. I don't know. All right? For anyone to say that AA, which has gone from 2 to 2 million with no promotion in 60 years, and is 150 countries and we're in 98,000 groups, so I'm sure it won't work for you. But to say, and we have the biggest aggregate of recoveries of any organization, therapy, or treatment in the world. To call that a crutch is so alarmingly deranged. But I judge no man. It's unbelievable, unbelievable. So if you're new here and you're using that AA crutch, keep crutching, baby. Keep using it. You're in good shape. And when I came in, I heard a lot of things, you know, that worked for me and a lot of things that didn't work for me. I will tell you this. It's been true since the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's true today. Anything I've heard in AA that pisses me off, I have never been able to find in this book. Not once. Never. Not one thing that has pissed me off in Alcoholics Anonymous have I gone, oh, it's in here. Crap. It's never in here. You know? I don't hear it that much anymore. I used to hear the alcoholics, and it's sort of a, you could sort of, if you really worked hard, sort of distill this from some of the stuff that's in the chapter to the employer. But you hear sometimes in AA that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have never heard this anywhere but in an AA meeting in my life. I've never heard it anywhere but in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I've never heard it at an Al-Anon meeting. I'll tell you that. Sometimes you hear alcoholics don't like change. I've heard people say, alcoholics, I'm an alcoholic and I don't like change. Not true for me. Never been true for me. I love change. I just don't like change I don't like. But I really like change I like. You know, I've never heard an alcoholic get to a podium and say, geez, I just hit the lottery. I'm going out with a pair of twins and it's killing me. You know, I've never heard that. I've just heard people get up and get pissed off about change they don't like. But again, I judge no man. And another thing I used to hear that confused the hell out of me is that alcoholics are perfectionists. I'm not a perfectionist. I'm a slob. I've been a slob my whole life. I like you to be a perfectionist. That's what I like. I like the people around me. I want my wife. I want my kids. I want my employer. I want these people to be a perfectionist. I'm a perfectionist about your perfectionism. I'm not a perfectionist. So I've heard a lot of things about alcoholism that have really worked for me in AA and in and out of AA. And I've heard a lot that not. You know, if you're gonna do that a whole lot, it's gonna really be distracting and difficult for me. I'm working on that. Well, we'll see you later. Okay. It's just it gets a little weird with people tripping in and out. But again, I judge no man because I and you know that because I've said it 5 or 6 times already. I caught alcoholism at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I didn't have it when I got here. My sponsor's fond of saying that the infection takes place at the meetings. It enters through the ear, and the person gets infected, and they start infecting everybody around them. And that's pretty much what happened to me. Again, I did not have alcoholism when I got here. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink because it might dull the pain. And you don't want to squander any agony opportunity. You want to really be there for any misery that comes your way. It's really fun talking like this. It's like watching people watch other stuff through half the talk. It's kind of an interesting thing. In addition to the Judaism, I could not possibly have been alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy is great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. My colossal error was that I was treating alcoholism with psychotherapy. I was showing up at a gunfight with a knife once a week, you know, and getting these colossal ass whoopings, just colossal ass whoopings, but doing really good work in therapy. If you have alcoholism, if it's impossible for you to control and enjoy your drinking or to moderate your drinking once you begin, now, this only takes place in a certain class of allergic people. It doesn't take place in normal people. And if you're special and a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking. You know, just, you know, fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in the mood today, and blow it out. And if you can do that, hats will fill the air. You know, I guarantee it. Or, you know, do some controlled slamming. You know, just get a register, decide, you know, I'm not in the mood, and squirt it on the wall and walk away. when I share that, there's usually one or two people who go, oh man. It's I'm wasting imaginary dope. That kills them, you know? No, don't waste the imaginary dope. Don't do that, man. That's still a sin. If that hurt you and I said that, you could have alcoholism. If you don't, what the hell is your problem, you know? But if you have this weird physical reaction that makes it impossible for you to moderate or control and enjoy, and this weird physical reaction that, again, only takes place in a certain class of people, is coupled with some fascinating thinking. It's called alcoholic thinking. It is the source of a lot of mirth at AA meetings. It's fabulous, fabulous stuff. You've all heard great examples of it if you've been around AA for any amount of time. If you're new, you probably are a great example of it. And I still come up with a couple of, you know, good ones now and again. I love reasons to drink. I collect them. I think they're just the greatest thing in the world. I have a friend named Larry who, the first time he ever read our book, he read the first page of the fourth chapter of the book, which pretty much it has this sentence that basically says to be doomed to an it doesn't basically it exactly says to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Let's see, die in a pool of my own urine, spiritual life. It's really a tough choice to make. And he said the first time that he ever read that sentence, he said to himself, well, how bad an alcoholic death are we talking about here? That's not normal. That's not a normal reaction to that. Normal people would. If you're new here and you're dreaming about drinking, normal people don't dream about drinking. My mother has never dreamt about walking into a palace made of cocaine. She's never had that dream. She's never once had that dream. So if you're dreaming about drinking, it doesn't mean you're going to drink. It means you're probably a drunk. Hold on to the dream, you know. Let it help you take that first step on maybe a little deeper level, because I defy you to produce one normal person who dreams about canoeing down a river of beer. I don't know of any. But I know alcoholics who do. My favorite reason to drink, which I've heard in the whole entire time I've been to AA, I heard it a couple years ago. It was from a guy. I was sponsoring this guy for about 10 minutes, and he lived with his wife. He was a male prostitute, and he had a gay lover. And he called me to tell me that he drank. And I said, oh, why? I want to know. I've got an inquiring mind, you know. And he said, this quick, man, he said, I caught my wife cheating on me. And you can't write that. You can't make that up. You can't. You can't manufacture that. Now, I know for a fact, because I'm an alcoholic, that thought, my wife was cheating on me, was either the product, either boom, he came up with it, boom, we've got a winner, right? Either it just boom came out, or it was the product of weeks of careful thinking and planning and cutting and trimming and rearranging reality to get into that box. I know that. And it doesn't matter if it's the product of, boom, an intuitive thought or an inspiration, or a couple of weeks in the rat's maze. It's the same. It's the same calamity. And one of the most baffling things about alcoholism is some of these things would just come to me. Some of these great ideas would just come to me, or I'd work on them. I'd consult with other people. I'd really develop this new approach to death. So, I came to AA after a long, terrible journey. I was brought up in the Bronx in New York City. Anybody from the Bronx? Nobody? No one's even here on the witness protection program? Nothing? No? A couple of people looked at their feet when I said that. So. Sometimes you have some guys say, yeah, I'm here on the witness protection program. Go! I grew up in an insane family. My family was completely out of their mind. My wife never believed me about him until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. and it was not a mistake. It was a look she was going after. It was. I wish I was lying about this. These are my people. This is not the kind of stuff. This is my genetic pool. And if you got anything for free in my family, I meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder who used to get free bales of steel wool. And his wife took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the free steel wool. So, you know, after a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you'd go to their house, when you'd go to their house and look at the room, everybody was moving a little bit. You know, the whole room, everybody was kind of up and down and moving around. It was like a living, breathing, pulsing thing. And they were nuts. I mean, there was chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts and mental and physical abuse. And it was just crazy. And if you're new here, all I've got is good news for you, because my family did not have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. They didn't do it. I'm not telling you they weren't nuts. They were nuts. And I'm not telling you I didn't get hurt. I got hurt. And I'm not telling you you didn't get hurt. I'm not telling you you don't got to do nothing about it. I'm not telling you that for a second. What I'm telling you is you can't make a drunk. You can't make this drunk. Can't do it. If you could, if my family had really made me an alcoholic, then I could go to psychotherapy, I could work out my family problems, and I could drink properly. I wouldn't have to go to parties anymore and say, oh, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier. Right? I wouldn't have to do that. I could just be like the normal people. But it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter how much psychotherapy I do. And again, I'm not putting it down. I got no beef with it. But if they didn't make me a drunk, they can't make me not a drunk. And it was bad news for me, because I really looked to therapy to get me out of the alcoholic dilemma I was in from Jump Street right away when I was a kid. I was being asked to leave educational institutions from, like, you know, 13, 14 on. I sold heroin to a New York City cop, which he cheated. He wasn't wearing a uniform, you know. And sneaky. And when I got arrested, I was like, I swear I thought he cheated, you know. Isn't that against the law? Wasn't that entrapment? You didn't identify yourself as a police officer before I sold you this heroin. You cheated. Man. And what I did besides the therapy, real young, was I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here today. You remember WOW, right? WOW. Wow. Right after wow usually came, what? Wow, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum, you know? There's a lot of activity, but no movement. But they're busy, busy, busy people. I triumphed over marijuana with pills. I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that gall darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. Then you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And then I drank till I don't want to be a drunk. And if I want to apologize for talking so much about drugs. I know that it upsets some people in AA. But I've been asked to. I don't mean to offend anybody. I've been asked to come and tell my story. And I use drugs to avoid catching alcoholism. And if you and it really annoys you, talk to the guy who asked me to talk. I didn't volunteer, and he's heard my story, so. I had one guy, I was talking up north, and a guy walked up to me after the meeting, just nuts. And one of my spiritual advisors said, you know, if an old timer really hates you for talking about drugs, he's probably taking them. Wow. I said, whoa. And I turned around, this guy's eyes were just glazed, and he said, why do you hate AA? And I thought, I don't hate AA. You're kind of pissing me off, though. I'm finding you personally annoying, but AA, I'm okay with AA. But he was real angry about it. So I like to apologize just because I don't feel bad about talking about it, but I don't want to I don't want anybody to need a meeting after the meeting on my account. If you do, it's I'd rather it was on your account, not mine. But one thing I'm really convinced of is that you can say anything or do anything in AA, and some of the people like it, and you'll piss some of the people off pretty good, and that's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. I know that because I've sat in meetings next to people, and I've heard the single worst speaker I've ever heard in my life, and they've heard the single best speaker they've ever heard in their life, and we were sitting in the same dimension, in the same time zone, right next to each other. And I guess that's why God made more than one of us, you know, and that's why AA works. When I was in my early 20s, I slammed some heroin, and my father had a massive stroke, and I was taken to the hospital, and I couldn't be there for him or my mother or my brother, and I just collapsed as a son and a man, and I just couldn't show up. There's probably a few times in a kid's life when he ought to be there for his old man, and this was one of them, and I couldn't answer the call. And I felt like an animal, like a pig. There were holes in my arms. The curtain was down. The sound of the heart machine couldn't even come through, you know. And I knew what the problem was, and I knew how to solve it. The problem was that goddamn heroin and those needles. And as long as I never put a needle in my arm again, I'd never be that guy again. I'd never be the guy who couldn't be there for his dad that morning ever again if I never repeated that behavior. I knew what the problem was, and I knew how to solve it, and I never put a needle in my arm again. At least not for 13 years. And shortly after this, I really set some lofty goals for myself when I was a kid. Because I wasn't going to be a loser like my old man. You know, I wasn't going to, like, you know, make money and bring it home, you know, and do any of that loser crap. My father never made more than $10,000 a year, and my brother and I never missed a meal and never went to school with ripped clothing. My last year out there, I made $80,000. My children went to school with ripped clothing all the time and missed meals all the time. Now, how does that happen? How can you put a picture of those two men down next to each other and come up with my father being a loser? Well, once a certain, if you're someone with alcoholic tendencies and a certain kind of thinking becomes established in you, and please, if you're new, please read the second and third chapters of our book because they describe this so gorgeously. Once that certain kind of thinking becomes established in you, it says you're probably beyond human help. Always good news for the new man. really thrilling. And it just blew my head up when I did that. I can't believe I just did that. But I thought my dad was a loser. And I set some lofty goals for myself, and by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had had my own theater in New York. I had directed a television show and a film. And I'd done all of these things a ton. I never got to do any of them more than once because when I'd leave, they'd move the business so I couldn't find it again. And I didn't realize why until I took the alcoholic test. If you're new, we've got a test. Other diseases, they got blood tests, they got x-rays. We've got an inventory. It's a pass-pass situation. Do the inventory, you will pass. And if you do it, if you write down the whole thing, if you write down the whole horrible mess and read the whole horrible mess to someone, you'll actually see a picture of your alcoholism. And when I took the alcoholic test when I was 6 months sober, and I saw the picture of my alcoholism, I saw that early on, people were doing things behind my back. A little later on, they started talking behind my back. And in the last few horrible years, they started thinking behind my back, which is horrible. It's hard to catch them, you know, number one. But you can catch them. You just got to accuse them of it all the time. And you'll nail these suckers eventually. You'll get them. Boy, what a world that is. What a world to live in that is when they're thinking behind your back, man. What a terrible, horrible place to live. When you're leaving and when you walk out, they pick up the phone and they go, "He's coming. Screw him. Get him. He's on his way." You know? I want to tell you, if one fraction the amount of time that I fancied was being spent thinking and doing about me, commerce would have grinded to a halt. There wouldn't have been any time to do anything else. If people really were focusing on me in really insane way, I thought that they were focusing on me. And I was acting in this Broadway play shortly after my dad died, and this new usherette with long brown hair walked into this theater, and I took one look at her, and I just, the earth opened up underneath me, and I just fell in love with this woman. She was exotic to me also. She was from Detroit. And I hadn't been out of the Bronx. I mean, I thought there were like palm trees in Detroit. I just had not been anywhere, you know. And we were in our early 20s. I was acting on Broadway. The world was at our feet, you know. We were living in New York City. We were young, and we were just a couple of dogs running on linoleum. I mean, we were going nowhere. We were dead. We had alcoholism. We didn't even know we had alcoholism. And Nancy became very sick from prolonged exposure to me. And we became so sick. One day I came home. We had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers in the house. And I come home and I pop a cork on a bottle of wine and I empty the entire bottle of wine into one of these things. And I turn around and my wife's looking at me like this. And I said, "What?" She said, "What are you doing?" And I looked at her completely seriously and I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." Can't a man have a glass of wine in his own home? Now, what are you going to argue with that? Let's look up glass? I mean, we got so sick that at one point a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car?" That's like house sitting for someone and they come home and you're in escrow, you know? And I'm telling you, I thought, and I don't know if the thought just came to me or if it was a couple of weeks in the making, but we had no money for the rent. I looked into my wife's eyes. I said, "Sweetheart, I am so sick of being an irresponsible punk kid. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's do the right thing. Let's not borrow money for the rent. Let's sell the car." Now, after that, then you got to go forge your signature on the pink slip. You got to do a few interesting things. It's called grand larceny auto. But that's not the presentation. The presentation is, let's finally be responsible and act like grown-ups. Let's sell the borrowed vehicle. And my wife looked into my eyes and said, "Let's do." Because the alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. Because we bring 7 people down for every one of us. That's what they say. We make 7 people sick. Which is okay, because that means if I get well, and if anybody tells you I don't want to get well, well, I stay away from those people. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says in chapter 7, tell a man he can get well. Tell a man he can get well, and I want to get well. I don't want to get good, I don't want to get cured, but I do want to get well because I've been sick. It says, tell a man get well, wife or no wife, job or no job. Tell a man he can get well if he brings this power into his life. You know, you guys told me I wasn't bad getting good, I was sick getting well. And I am. Now, I tell you, I might not have been bad, but I sure did a really good imitation of a bad guy. So I understand what you're saying, that I wasn't bad, I was sick, but I felt bad and I wanted to start feeling good. And in order to do that, I started doing some stuff that made me feel good. Made me feel good. I hung out with people who were doing that. Sometimes you hear in AA, you can do anything you want in sobriety as long as you're willing to pay the price. I can't tell you how much that doesn't work for me, and I'll just tell you why. I'm not telling you not to do stuff. Here's why. The conceit there, the assumption, the insane assumption is that you'll be able to do whatever you want and be able to stay sober because you've decided you're willing to pay the price. That's the insane notion there. It's one of the craziest things I hear in AA. I'm not saying buy a robe, go to a monastery, but to say to me, I can do this because I'm willing to pay the price, that is one of the most actively alcoholic statements I've ever heard. Because the assumption is that I'll be able to do it. Just like I assumed I could shoot a little dope or snort a little coke or drink a little booze. But I tell you, man, when I have a drink of alcohol, I go, normal people don't do that. Normal people don't do that. When normal people drive by a liquor store, their mouth doesn't flood with saliva. They don't drool. Their eyes don't glaze over. They don't get a little froth in their mouth. They don't. I do. We had 2 kids who became very sick from alcoholism. When Michael was born, and we were surrounded by friends and family. There was a ton of phone calls. He was really welcomed into the world. And 2 years and 9 months later, when Jesse was born, there were no friends, no flowers, no phone calls. We were completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism. And it isn't because people didn't love us. It just hurt too much to be around us. The ice around our heart had become so thick, it just had repelled everybody. And Jesse was born. There was nobody there. He went up into neonatal intensive care. He had a heart problem. And that night, a doctor who I had never met called me up and said, "Mr. Redmond, your wife is in a lot of trouble. She's in a lot of psychological duress. She's all alone." Now, you guys know that there's no greater place to be in the world than a maternity ward when stuff's going good. There's no more wonderful, celebratory place in the world. And if when things aren't going good, there ain't many places worse to be if you do not have a God and if you're all alone and you have cut yourself off from your fellows. There's really, I can't think of many worse places to be when you're alone. And you know what I mean by alone. I mean alcoholically alone. And this doctor called me and said, "Your wife's in a lot of trouble. Your baby's upstairs. Your wife has no help, no support. Can you come on down to the hospital?" And I said, "You know, I'd love to, but the fact is I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old son." And this doctor, who I'd never met before, said to me on the phone that day, "I'll tell you what, why don't you call my house? My husband's home. Why don't you go to my house, bring your kid over there, and my husband will watch your kid." That's pretty remarkable. I mean, from anybody, and a doctor to boot. I mean, somebody I didn't know. And I said, no. There was no way that I could accept this person's kindness and generosity. I think in order to accept it, you know, sometimes when you were confronted with help, I couldn't accept the help because it would have made me take a look at my life. It would have made me take a look at how had I wound up here? How did I wind up here alone at this time in life when it's, the opposite should be happening? I don't think I could, I couldn't bear to accept your generosity. Stop and just take a look at what had happened. And, it's not like I helped my older son out. Now he was trapped in the house with this insane man who was racked with guilt and self-loathing. I would have done better, I think, for him if I had taken him down to the hospital and left him in the waiting room with a coloring book. At least he could have gotten the hell away from me for a while. That's where we wound up by the time we got to AA. This is a good morning at the Redmond home. This is where we wound up. I went to the doctor. The doctor said to me, "Mr. Redmond, you have high blood pressure. You need to lose some weight." And I said to him, "Well, I'd like to do that. But before I go to bed every night, I drink alcohol and I smoke marijuana, so I'm not going to be able to." And he said to me, "Why don't I prescribe some medication for you?" And I said to him, "What a country." And he prescribed for me chloral hydrate, which what chloral hydrate is if you ever watch those 30s films where there's an unruly sailor in a bar that puts some white powder in his drink and he drinks it and falls backwards like a piece of masonite, that's chloral hydrate. It's a Mickey. It's a knockout drop. And I love these pills. I love them. I love my knockout drops, right? And I'm taking handfuls of these knockout drops, but you don't want to waste a good knockout drop, right? So Nancy comes home. I'm taking handfuls of Mickey's, and I'm slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drop. And I keep taking the knockout drops and slamming parts of my body into the wall to keep myself conscious to enjoy the knockout drop until I just short circuit and just keel over. So now, because I got so much Mickey in me, I can't get out of bed to go to the bathroom, and I'm becoming incontinent like the rest of the 30-year-old men in America, right? I'm wet in the bed every night. So one night, I got up, and I wet the wall. I peed on the wall, and the next morning, everyone was excited, you know? He peed on the wall. He's headed towards the bathroom. He's headed in the right direction. You know, this is progress, not perfection. Things are getting better. It was like a Wheaties morning, you know, in the Redmond home. That's where we wound up with, "It's a good day, Dad wet the wall." On April 20th, 1985, I crossed the line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. And by that time, our older son, Micah, was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat he couldn't stop making. He was reading and writing years below his grade level. He couldn't stop grinding his teeth. He was cut off from the society of other children. His small motor skills were screwed up from being scared all the time, from being distracted all the time. And Jesse had just started to disappear. He was 3, but if you get in between me and the drink, and you're my kid, you gotta vanish. You either have to become something less than human or you have to disappear because I'm going to get to the drink. I will get to the drink no matter what. And when Micah was 5, he came to me and he said, "Dad, is there anything such as God?" And I looked into the eyes of my perfect 5-year-old baby boy and I said, "No, there isn't, son." And I swear to you, I thought I was giving him the real deal. And what I was, in fact, was saying to him something horrible. And it was a lie. What I was saying to him was, you know, when it's dark and you're alone in your room and it's too scary to go to sleep. What I was saying to him is, when it's dark and it's scary and you can't go to sleep, tough, because that's all there is. That's really what I was saying to him. If that's not child abuse, I really don't know what is. I think it's the worst piece of information you can give to a child. And on April 20th, I crossed a line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm, and my world came crumbling down around me, because as long as I held that line, as long as I didn't do that, I was okay. But I crossed the line. I called my therapist of record, my first Jungian therapist, and I told him what I had done, and he said to me, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." I said, "What?" He said, "I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or rehab you institutionalized." Why I went to that AA meeting, I don't know. I don't know. I got loaded for two more days. Came home, poured a glass of... I went to an AA meeting. I came home, I poured a glass of wine for myself, and my wife said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Honey, they're not fanatics at AA. You don't stop drinking completely. You know, they're civilized people. You still have a glass of wine, an occasional glass of wine. You just don't get drunk." And on April 23rd, 1985, I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning and put my best clothes on to go and report to the ANA. I went to a place called Unit A, which at the time was on Victory Boulevard, right next to the Tonga Hut. Now I want to tell you, I think if Satan is manifested on Earth, I think he is manifested in Polynesian-themed restaurants and bars. Them big carved heads, baby. When you're loaded and you got to be looking at one of them big carved heads all night, what an order, you know? It's really, and they were right next to the, you know, the Unit A was right next to the Tonga Hut with that. One of them big carved heads out front. And I walked in there at 7 a.m. and looked around and just hated everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I just hated it. I couldn't believe it. I just took one look around and said, "Alcoholics Anonymous, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous." And everything was a miracle, miracle, miracle. I'm a miracle. He's a miracle. The coffee's a miracle. The furniture's a miracle. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. And that, and if you're new, you're now privy to an unending, unsolicited reservoir of information and advice. They're going to get right up in your face and talk this endless, unsolicited AA crap to you. And you know the guy. It's usually a guy with, like, one tooth with a cavity in it, you know? Do I want what you've got? No. No. No, but thanks for spitting on me. I really appreciate it. You know the guy's got a belt buckle large enough to serve a whole fish on, right? And I hated everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why I came back. The only reason that I can imagine that I came back is that I was out of plans. And if you're new, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. The single most used newcomer plan I've seen in the last years has been the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. That's... Right? It's out there, baby. It's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually, because it's out there, man. When you go south, like near San Diego, and you share that, a lot of guys look at their feet real quick, you know? You get around Lemon Grove, they don't want to hear that crap at all, you know? And I guess I was out of plans, because I kept coming back. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept coming back, and I stayed around about 6 months. And enjoyed the gift of step none. You know the gift of step none? Nothing. That's the gift of step none. And I was getting nothing big time. And I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. I didn't even know I had alcoholism, let alone untreated alcoholism. You could pick out the untreated alcoholics at the meeting pretty quick. They usually have like a vein pumping like a garden hose on their forehead. They're a pretty relaxed, friendly lot. And I ran into some new old-timers who were... You know, telling me to shut up, and I was a moron, and I was there a couple of months, and I said, oh, these guys are mean. And then I heard certain guys say, I really need to be treated that way. And I said to myself, I really need to not be treated that way. Because a lot of the guys that were doing a lot of the shut up, you're a moron, you're an idiot, it felt just like home to me, you know. I said, I really don't need this. I don't need to be, now if you're going to use the scalpel of love without the scalpel of truth without the anesthetic of love, keep it. I don't want it. And I just veered away from those guys. I stayed away as far away from those guys as I possibly could. And I gravitated to a bunch of guys who were getting to podiums and talking about the big book and the steps and the spiritual principles in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, granted, they weren't very interested in hearing my views on life and love and art and politics, and they excused themselves when I'd start to go on about that. But they didn't beat me up. They didn't treat me like crap, and they didn't call me names. And I'm not putting down the people who do that, who say that they needed that when they came in. All I'm saying is I didn't need it, didn't want it, never been. And anytime I'm around it, I just go move in the other direction. My sponsor's the same way, and he's got 30 years. My other spiritual advisor is 28 years sober, and he's a guy who had a really mean sponsor, who really beat the living crap out of him. And yet he's able to pass on a different message to me. So I just know if you're new, I know you'll be able to find what you need here. I've never met anybody who, if they were willing to stick around, didn't find the AA that was perfect for them. And I don't put down the other thing. It's just not part of my story, and I've been asked to tell my story again. If my story pisses you off, go see him after the meeting. I knew I was going to drink at 6 months. I had done nothing. I was receiving nothing. And I had seen the AA drill in just 6 months. I saw people come in. I was hanging out at the old North Hollywood group, and there were a lot of incredible old-timers around there, like Alabama Carruthers and people who were just extraordinary, who I was fortunate enough to hang out with. You know, I'm lucky. And people come in, and I had watched. People came in and did the work and changed. People came in, didn't do the work, didn't change, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us, and then shared their ass right out of the door. Or stayed here and became columns of human sewage and sexual predators, although I judge no man. And because I'm too damn spiritually developed to judge anybody. But. So I knew I was going to drink, and my wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and had started her miracle, and my sons had just become a little less frightened. And AA was rearing its head in my life despite me. And I knew I was going to drink. So I asked a guy to sponsor me. And I did something I had rarely done in my life. I went to a good guy for something he had. My MO was to go to a drowning person and ask for swimming lessons. And then when all they'd say is glub, 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 get pissed off. You know, that was sort of my deal. And I went to this guy, and he made sure I'd done some reading from the big book of AA. And he invited me to his apartment afterwards. He read chapter 5 to me, and on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3, and we said a prayer together. And then he went back, and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stopped feeling like I was stealing someone's seed here. I really did. I didn't have, like, any burning bush experience, but I really did feel like I stopped feeling like I was stealing someone's seed. I had been going to book studies and step studies. I had nothing to share because I had done nothing. Anytime I'm at a step study, and anyone sharing begins with the following sentence, well, I've never actually worked this step, but I always say, but what the hell will you be talking about then? I mean, if you've been asked to talk on a subject that you just told us you have absolutely no practical knowledge about, what exactly are you going to be talking about? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but because I'm so darn non-judgmental, it doesn't bother me. So I started being able to talk about some stuff at these meetings because I had actually done something. I had actually done some work. It took me 3 months, and I went back and read my fifth step to my sponsor. And, sometimes people say that they mostly resented themselves. And I know that that's true for them. Some of the guys I sponsor say they mostly resented themselves as opposed to other people. And I know it's true for them, and I know it's absolutely not true for me. I resented myself, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I hated you so much more than I hated me. it's hard to even describe it. I'm not a suicide person. I'm a homicide person. I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have. As far as I'm concerned, you go first, you know. And believe me, I'm not knocking the suicide people. This is not a put down, you know. That's just where I go. You go first. And so I had a lot of work to do. And it took me 3 months, and I went to my sponsor and read my fifth step, and I did step 6 and 7 for the first time. And I wrote up my 8-step list. I try to share this anytime I talk. It's the best reading of the 8-step I've ever heard in my life. And it happened in my old home group, and it was done by a guy who I'd never seen before the night I heard him do this, and I've never seen him since. His name was Nino. He had a heavy New York accent, and he had never read Chapter 5 before. And he was there with a hospital group. He had hospital plastic on his wrist. And he got to the podium of this men's group that night, and he read Chapter 5 for the first time, and he got up to Step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen this? Do you know what is in here?" It was so beautiful. It was so pure. It was the purest reading of the step I have ever seen in my life. And I absolutely identified, because it's the only thing I saw in the steps when I saw the steps. I didn't see any other step. Not that money, not those people. No, no, no. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back. No way. Right? No way would I have taken that much money if I knew I would be paying it back now. Not the car. When I called that guy to make amends, his voice was exactly the same as when he found out I sold. He said, "You're paying me back?" It was like he was frozen on that end of the phone, you know, through the whole thing. And so I did my 8-step list. My wife and my kids and my dad were down there. I didn't know what the heck I was going to do about it. I didn't know what I was going to do. I couldn't go to the grave and talk to my father, and I couldn't write him a letter. It didn't work for me. Wish it had. Would have made my life a lot easier, but it didn't. It didn't work for me. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. My sponsor said, "Do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just do your job in AA." And I did my job. And for me, my job isn't talking in meetings. It's not being a circuit speaker, and it's not talking. I love you guys. I'm glad I'm here this morning, but I don't think this keeps me sober for 2 minutes. Not for a minute. Not even for half a minute. Does doing what I'm doing this morning keep me sober? For me. And I'll tell you why. If it did, then I guess I'd have to do it. So if you stopped asking me to talk, I guess I'd drink. I mean, I don't mind doing the service. As far as I'm concerned, this is a coffee commitment with a microphone. You know? And it's not any more important than the coffee commitment, and I'm nothing. I'm just a drunk. I am nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I hope I vanish, and all that's left is the spirit that you guys have filled me up with. Because the smaller I get, the bigger my life gets. Nowhere in the first 164 pages of the Big Book of AA does it say the road gets narrower. Nowhere in it. All it talks about is life getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It says, join us in the mainstream of life. Help us pack things into the mainstream of life. Join us in the firing line of life. Join us on the broad highway. Become part of the big idea, the great reality. All it talks about is life getting bigger and bigger and bigger, never smaller. On April 22nd, 1985, the road was plenty narrow. I had this miserable, disgusting little Scott Redman life. I couldn't go anywhere, I couldn't talk to anybody, and I couldn't do anything. And now there's virtually nowhere I can't go and nobody I can't talk to. Huge, huge life, this bounty that you guys have presented me with. And it isn't from talking. If I stop doing what my sponsor did with me that day with other men, I am convinced I will drink, or even worse, I won't drink, but I'll just stay here and become one of the frozen chosen, you know. That little gray tunnel sobriety that you trudge down once a year, a cake comes down, you blow the candles up, it goes back up, and you just keep walking, you know. Fun. Man. And I did my 8-step list, and my sponsor wouldn't tell me how to make amends, and he just said, do your job in AA, and I started doing my job in AA, which was to, you know, I mean, He said, just don't give away anything you don't have. If all you have is a car and a quarter, lend someone a dime and give them a ride. Just don't give anything away you don't have. He said, you've worked 4.5 steps now. You can't give away 5. And I read my 5th step. He said, okay, you got 5. Are you doing 6 and 7? You can give that away. You know, and if you haven't done your inventory yet, you know, you're enjoying the gift of step 3.5, which is nothing. After a period of time, I mean, if you haven't done your inventory yet, well, I've worked the first 3 steps. Okay, I've admitted I'm an alcoholic. That's a fatal illness. That my life's unmanageable. That it's a mess. And then I have come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Not would or should, but that it's possible. People who need to be restored to sanity are nuts. The 3rd step I've taken, but it says it'll have little permanent or lasting effect unless immediately followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that are harming me. So it says step 3 will come and go if I haven't done a 4th. So all I've done is admitted, I'm nuts, I'm dying, and my life sucks. How come I don't feel any better? Well, after a while, why the hell would you feel any better? There's no real reason. So I had to know this. I had to know this. If you're new and you still want to drink, imagine my shock that you would still want to drink. And if you're looking in the big book of AA for where it says that's going to go away, take a look at the description of step 10 and please read Dr. Bob's Nightmare, because it talks about that beautifully in both sections of the book. In step 10, it says sanity will have been restored. When I came to AA, I heard people talking about their brain in the 3rd person as if it was some unwanted alien dashing around their house planning their undoing. I said, oh, I feel that way right now. Got anything different? And the fact is nowhere in the book does it say that you will have to live as if your head's out to get you. Nowhere in the book. It says that if you get into self, you'll get sick, and you are a danger to yourself and others, and you need to do some stuff. But it says, in fact, sanity will have been restored in step 10 to continue to take inventory. The alcohol problem will be removed. I'll know the correct use of self-will. In step 11, it says the occasional hunch or inspiration will actually become a working part of the mind, which for you pot smokers means, wow, actually stays. Huh? Not bad. That's pretty cool. And in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, he says something that I've used many times in a lot of different ways, and I just love it. He says, sometimes when he wants to drink, this is the last page of his story, he says that he must remember that he has so frightfully abused his right to drink that he's lost it. And I have so frightfully abused my opinion of where you stand in the universe, I've lost the right to express it. I've so frightfully abused my right to control the life of my wife and my children that I've lost it. I've so frightfully abused so many things, I've lost them, and if I'm going to have any peace, I have to let this power in. I've got to let him in. It says in the last sentence of chapter 4, when I draw close to him, he reveals himself to me. And the way I draw close is by continuing to take inventory, continuing to make amends, and try to improve and expand my spiritual life. My sobriety date is April 22nd, 1985, and if I stick around, I'll be 13. And I want more. I want it to get bigger. I want to learn more. And in the last few years, I changed sponsors, and I've had a great time with this new sponsor. He's taken me to a lot of the literature that Bill and Bob were using when they framed the big book, and a lot of the, I'm not going to talk about it from the podium, it's non-conference approved literature. If anybody wants to talk to me about it or ask me about it, please get my phone number after you're done complaining about my talk. Because I have to leave here in about 6-7 minutes, and I don't get to even stay for the closing prayer. I got to get to work, so I'm going to kind of finish my talk and walk out. And I could leave now, actually. I started doing my job in AA, and I started doing lame stuff, lame crap. I started, you know, showing up to flag football games and coaching the Little League and going to school and explaining to the teachers that my kids were sick and that's why they were having a hard time, and they were sick because they had lived with me. And we started getting some resources cut loose for the boys, and our children started to recover. I was like a year sober, and my son Micah, I was sponsoring this guy named Roland, and he used to call me every night, and he'd leave a message on my answering machine saying, Scott, it's Roland, I love you, I'm sober, good night, and he'd hang up. And 5 years later, when I was 6 years sober, my son Micah came to me, who I told you was so sick, you know, and so crushed up from alcoholism. And he said to me that when I was a year sober, he couldn't fall asleep until he heard Roland's voice on the machine. Once he heard Roland's voice on the machine, he knew it was safe to go to sleep. And this is the kid I told there was no God. You guys came over the answering machine and you tucked him in every night. He knew that if I wasn't sober, Roland wouldn't continue to call. He knew that. I'm sorry were the two most useless words in my vocabulary. For him, the demonstration of the power of God in AA was the fact that this guy called every night, because he knew that he wouldn't. And I think sometimes what was happening was he would stay up until he just passed out from being scared. And once he heard Roland's voice on the machine, he knew it was okay to close his eyes and drift off. Mike is up in college now. He goes to Olympia College and to Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington, and he's going to be 20. And he's just a great guy. He's just a great guy who came from this horrible, crushed, wrecked, ruined place. You know? And some months ago, he was babysitting for a couple on the program, and the guy in this couple said to him, "What do you think of hearing your dad talk in AA?" And Micah said, "I really don't care much about it. I don't really care much about it. I don't know anything about it." He said, "All I can tell you is that since I'm a very, very little boy, the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have taken very, very good care of me, and never once has one of them demanded that I believe what they believe." I really think it's one of the most remarkable compliments I've ever heard for the program. And that's not based on something he's parroting. That's based on 12 years of his own personal experience as a child growing up in and around AA and Al-Anon. And that's not evangelism, it's not promotion, it's not bullying. His expression of what's happened for him in AA, Dr. Bob said if you take all 12 steps, all the principles, everything, and boil them down, they all boil down to love and service. And Micah's compliment to the program, a compliment for you guys, is one of the purest expressions I've ever heard of that. If you're new, I'm not telling you, if you get and stay sober, that your wife, that Nancy and I are married 23 years and we're working it out. You know, we have good times, we have bad times, we're hanging together, and we're in there. You know, we stopped working on our relationship. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. You know, that's my idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, and on the way down you go, "Oh, okay." We had to start working on ourselves and try to bring a better person to the deal. And but if you're new, I'm not telling you your kids are going to get better and your marriage is going to stay together. I got to do my job in AA no matter what. I got to do my job in AA. If my kids get better, or if they get sick and they get on drugs and they die. If I'm living in the house on the hill or a refrigerator box, I got to do my job in AA. My job might be how to show a guy how to stay sober through a divorce or to stay sober through a happy marriage. I got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, I just pray for you. If you do your inventory, you'll find out what your job in AA is going to be. You'll find out how and who you're going to be able to help, and en route to that, you'll help people you never even imagined you could help. But you won't drink. You gotta not drink. If you're new here, you gotta not drink. Sometimes you can go to an AA meeting and not even hear a passing reference made to God, the Big Book, or the steps. And I get confused. If I go to a meeting and all I hear about is issues and boundaries, I get confused. If you're new here, you gotta not drink to have an issue or a boundary. If you don't drink, you'll have an issue and a boundary. I guarantee it. But you gotta not drink. The not drinking part's a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we'd be a much bigger organization. I guarantee it. If you're new and you're wondering when you're gonna get in touch with your feelings, stay sober. They'll get in touch with you. I guarantee it. If you're new, I want to welcome you to AA. I want to also tell you that my family and I got whacked in the Northridge earthquake. We really got creamed. Our house got wrecked up. We got really scared. It was pretty terrible stuff. And went to an AA function out of town shortly after the quake, and this woman at the AA function said to me, "Oh, I'm so glad that we got out of LA before the quake." And I said to her, and she didn't say, "I'm glad we got out." She said, "I'm glad God got us out of LA before the quake." So I said to her, "So he likes you, but we're crap, but he likes you." And she said to me, "Well, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn." Oh, bartender. Hello. I'm out of here. If I have a god up there that's saying, get the Redmond boy, get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him. I'm out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Absolutely nothing to do with it. I got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if there's an earthquake or if there's not an earthquake. If Nancy and I stay together or we don't stay together. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to just suggest again, just stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. Stick around long enough to catch alcoholism. I got a terrible case of it one day at a time. And I want to tell you, if you're new, I'm not as close to my next drink as you. I'm not. My not drinking muscle is a lot stronger than yours. Your drinking muscle is a lot stronger than mine. All I got is till 24, all I got is till 12 o'clock tonight. I don't get any time more than you, but I'm not in the kind of danger you're in. Otherwise, what the hell am I doing up here? Why aren't you up here talking? Not that I might, you know, I think anybody here can give the talk. I really do. I really do. So I'm just trying to share this with you so you'll know I don't feel in that kind of danger anymore. I don't feel insane all the time anymore. I got plenty of problems in sobriety, but I'm surrounded by old timers and people with experience, strength, and hope that share this stuff with me and tell me how to get through it. If you're new here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. I'm sorry I have to split so fast, but I got to get to work, guys.